This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. I want to thank my newest rater and reviewer on the Apple Podcast Store, This Texan. Thank you so much for the very kind words. You can rate and review the podcast on the Apple Podcast Store. You can rate the podcast on Spotify. And please subscribe to the podcast wherever you are listening. This past week, I was on Instagram Live with Robert Peoples of Affinis Humanity. We finally got that done, so I will have the links in the show notes to that interview. And I just want to thank Robert for being incredibly patient with me. Through the experience, I've gained a tremendous amount of empathy for my guests and the technical issues that we run into. Basically, every technical problem that we could have run into, we did, and including the beginning of the live recording, my camera's facing the wrong direction. So it was a lot of fun. I really appreciate Robert. I think he is an amazing human being and an amazing humanist. To be human is enough continues to be a profound and deep concept that I learned from Robert. Thanks, Robert, for having me on. The Deconversion Anonymous Facebook group continues to be an amazing community that we are building. You can find that at facebook.com/groups/deconversion. Our community manager, Arlene, continues to hold Tuesday evening discussion groups about the most recent episode. So join Deconversion Anonymous and participate in the community and participate in these discussions. Mike had the week off this week, so if you have any complaints about the editing, direct them towards me. On to today's show. My guest today is Jan, and today's show requires a fairly strong content warning. Jan's focus is on mental health, and she goes into fairly specific detail about her mental health struggles. These include abuse, they include depression, they include suicidal ideation. So if any of those things are at all triggering for you, this is probably not the episode for you. Jan is a speaker for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, and she is fairly accomplished at telling her story. So she does an amazing job of being incredibly vulnerable and incredibly honest. What is interesting about Jan's story is that she has only recently discovered the deconversion and deconstruction community. She has participated in the Deconversion Anonymous community, and a significant part of her story is this discovery of community that she didn't know existed. Jan's message is that you are not alone, that there is always hope. We will have links in the show notes for a number of resources if you are struggling with mental health in any way. Here is Jan to tell her story. Jan, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast.
Thank you so much.
So Jan, I appreciate you reached out to me. You mentioned that you have a similar story to previous guests, that you've been a missionary at one point in time or another, but very specifically, you were interested in talking about some of the mental health aspects of deconstruction. So I'm excited to have you on. Thank you so much for reaching out to me.
Well, that's correct. I'm surprised at how many people there are out there who have gone through the same thing. And when I found your podcast, and I was actually very excited to find out about some fellow missionaries.
So Jan, the way we always start is to get a feel for what your religious experience was growing up. So what kind of faith tradition did you grow up with?
I grew up in fundamentalism in a fundamentalist Baptist church in a small town in Iowa. So it's very typical from what I've been hearing from a lot of people. It's kind of eerie, like there was a script that everybody followed because we have the same experiences, which was why it was so comforting to me when I found groups of people. And it was the first time that I'd been able to share and hear the same things from other people, especially at my age, a little bit older.
It's amazing. There are so many touch points, so many similarities, even when we come from fairly diverse backgrounds. And so there are obvious differences at times, but often you hear your story being told through someone else's story.
Yes. So I believed everything I was taught, and I wanted to be a good girl and to earn love. Mm. And so I went along with everything that I was taught, because of course, as a child, that's what you do. You don't have any other way to think. But I call it drinking the Kool-Aid.
Yes.
It's so striking to me now that I look back and I think that as children, we don't have that choice.
Right.
So you just go along with it. But I had the typical restrictions of a strict household. And of course, why I was so isolated was we weren't encouraged to play with children outside the church. Mm. So you have very few friends. And so, of course, you don't get outside influences. And we weren't allowed to question authority or question anything.
Right.
So, of course, there's no way to develop any critical thinking skills. On the other hand, I actually liked going to church.
Mm, okay.
Because it was a safe place.
Right. Yeah.
Because my dad was physically and verbally abusive.
Oh, no. All right.
And so there's this cognitive dissonance. So that's always, a huge thing. Like, this does not make sense. But again, as a child, you can't even articulate that or understand it. But I couldn't understand why things were so different between home and church. So when I went to church, people treated me well. Mm. And they were happy. They seemed happy.
Yeah.
So especially, we're talking about Iowa, Midwest. These are salt of the earth people. Uh-huh. And to this day, I know that they are well-meaning and they are very caring. I go to church and it would be like, wow, this is great. And then as soon as we got in the car, things would get ugly.
Okay.
Or when we got home. But my dad was a very angry person, and my parents had a cold relationship. Mm. And they were very negative and critical. So the other thing that didn't make sense to me was as soon as we got home, they would criticize all the people that we had just interacted with at church.
Okay.
And over Sunday lunch, they would roast the pastor, so to speak, and say everything that they didn't like about him and the sermon. That was very puzzling.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the funny things was one day I'm sitting next to my mom during the sermon, and she's traced on the bulletin with her finger. So she traced B-O-R-I-N-G.
Okay. So
I'm thinking, at the time it was funny, but now looking back, I go, why were we there then?
Yeah.
Why? I mean, every time the doors were opened, we were there.
Interesting. So very dedicated, even though they felt a little bored.
Yep, boring. My mom was quite funny, actually. She was very funny. But looking back, I noticed, wow, there was tiny, tiny seeds of doubt. Mm. And I know it was significant because I can remember it so well, even though it was a long time ago. So, of course, we had to listen to missionaries. We had a lot of missionaries. And they would come and do their presentations, and they were boring. But I would think, they talk about all these lost people overseas. And for some reason, I remember thinking about China. Of course, China has so many people. And I just remember the feeling more than anything, because that's what we remember, the feelings. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking, how can all those people be going to hell?
Right.
That doesn't really make sense. I mean, why?
Yeah.
Of course, we were told why. They haven't accepted Christ, they're going to hell. But that didn't feel right to me.
And about how old were you at this time?
Well, at that time, probably 10.
I just find this as a repeated pattern as well, that as children, people make the moral observation that there is something drastically wrong with this message.
Ah, it is a moral observation. Oh, that's funny. That's a whole aspect. Like, yeah, because I believe we're born innocent and good, and we have an internal moral compass. And yeah, another contradiction is like, oh, we're taught to be kind, and because Jesus tells us to love one another. And then it's like, wait,
yeah.
How come we're telling these other people they're going to hell? That's not nice.
Yeah. Point well made.
But I just kept going. I was very dedicated. And I ended up going to Oral Roberts University.
Okay.
Tulsa, Oklahoma. That's a whole story. But what's interesting is the day I got there was one of the happiest days of my life. And I actually had a good experience, because for me at that time was a step up. It was a milestone for several reasons. One is that you're very isolated, of course, in a small town in Iowa, and at least Tulsa was bigger. And I started experiencing things that I'd never experienced before. And I saw happy people there.
Yeah.
Happy families, in contrast to mine. And I only grew up with a brother. And I actually have two older sisters, but they are so much older that they were gone when I grew up. So when I got to school, and of course we had segregated dorms, you know, the girls and the boys, and all of a sudden I had all these sisters, these friends.
Yeah.
That was wonderful. And so we were silly and happy, and we had fun. And I started seeing, I mean, I couldn't even articulate it, but I started seeing that people actually had relationships.
Right.
They actually talked to each other, and they were positive. And that was a big thing about Oral Roberts. You know, it was all about being positive. And I mean, this was foreign to me.
I do want to say, we say this fairly often, but just to point out that there are definite positive benefits to church or Bible colleges or what have you. And most of that benefit is the community. It's the relationships that we make.
Yes.
And so it's totally natural and normal to look back fondly on what for you was a positive experience and ultimately even better than your home life, right?
It was. Because I dread to think if I had gone somewhere else in a small town, because it was a little different theology. I wouldn't even characterize it so much as fundamentalism, but it was definitely, of course, evangelical.
Yeah.
And even though we had weird rules, so we had a dress code, we had to report to church, we had to report to chapel and all those things, but that was nothing new to me. I mean, I had all rules at home. I thought it was wonderful. And I just kept believing it, because that's the subtlety of brainwashing. It's like you said, even though it has positive aspects, but the problem is you're not getting any other influences and you're not developing any critical thinking skills.
Right.
There were some weird things that went on there, but
okay.
I'm going to stick to the deconstruction.
Okay. Yeah. I think all of us have war stories and interesting elements of Bible college experience. So yeah, it sounds like yours was just like everybody else's.
Just like, well, Oral's quite unique, but he could get angry, but
yeah. Interesting.
What happened with me, one significant thing was what happened with my roommate's mother. So, of course, Oral Roberts was very involved with healing. Mm-hmm. And my roommate's mother had crippling rheumatoid arthritis.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And Oral had these weekend seminars where people from all over would come to the seminars. And toward the end, they would have, you know, a big healing line. Everybody that wants to be prayed for to be healed gets in this line. Well, they came. My roommate's parents came bringing the mother. Mm-hmm. And we were all excited thinking, well, she's going to be healed. She goes through the line. She was in a wheelchair. she goes through the line and we're all waiting. And here the father is pushing her in the wheelchair. Well, nothing happened.
Yeah.
She was the same.
Yeah.
So my mind, I was like, wait, I thought she was going to get up and I thought she was going to be healed.
Right.
And it affected me more than it did. She just took it in stride, which, you know, that whole thing of explaining it away.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so deflated. I just thought, wow, what happened?
And I want to point out here again, it is that you really believed that God could act, right? I think so much of the criticism of deconstruction misses the point that it is the faithful, like yourself, who get disappointed because you believed God could actually act and he didn't. Huh? Nothing happened.
Well, there was other stories, and I think that most of them were stories.
Right.
I mean, to this day, I wouldn't even doubt if there are some times that things happen. But it's just that we had been taught so much that, okay, you have to do this, which now I see is so ridiculous. You have to adhere to the formula and take the steps. So, of course, if you don't do it right, it's not going to work. So it's always your fault.
Blame the victim, yeah.
But nobody said, of course, nobody's going to say, must have been her fault. She didn't have enough faith. But it's just another doubt that gets put on the shelf. So I love the analogy of the shelf. I actually heard this from somebody else on another podcast where we just kept putting doubts on the shelf.
Yeah, I stole it from Amy Logan, so I'll give her credit for it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so she does the Ex-Mormonology podcast, for a shout out for her.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of analogies, but I like this one because that's what happened to me, is I just kept putting them on the shelf, but the shelf kept getting heavier.
Yes.
Then a really significant thing I did was I was fortunate enough to study abroad.
Oh, okay, cool.
It was my junior year in college. I had been taking courses in Spanish and I fell in love with it. And I mm-hmm. loved that. And I was invited to study in Granada, Spain semester. Yeah. I can't believe my parents let me go. So to me, if you believe in miracles, it's like, that was a miracle.
Yeah.
Because no, you have to be sheltered. You have to stay home, and anything out of the United States is bad. And there's terrorists over there. But I got to go. It was wonderful. Absolutely life-changing because I lived with a family and I fell in love with them. But what's interesting is that they were Christians and they weren't Catholic. They were Protestant.
Okay.
And they were evangelical, but much to my surprise. So I found out, well, I soon observed, these Christians were smoking and drinking. Heaven yeah. forbid.
Yeah.
I was absolutely dumbfounded.
Yeah.
But of course, time went on and I love these people. And it's like, wow, they're Christians, but they're smoking and, you know, drinking beer, drinking wine, drinking alcohol. How can that be?
Right.
But again, just put that aside. Just accept it. It is what it is. But that was a huge seed that was planted that just started to sprout.
Okay.
Thinking, what's going on here? I loved being there so much that I cried when I had to leave.
Oh, yeah, I bet. Yeah.
But my worldview had expanded, and there is no turning back from that.
Yeah, you can't unsee or unlearn those kinds of life lessons.
No. It was wonderful. But I came back to ORU because I continued to drink the Kool-Aid. So in fact, I was very much involved in outreach and missions. So I ended up actually a total of 3 times going to Mexico.
Okay.
These little mission trips. And by the time I graduated, I thought, you know, I've got to go into service somehow. I was convinced, because this is what I've been fed.
Right.
Well, your life is meaningless unless you serve God. You've got to do this. But now I could say, well, then why did we have business majors and science majors? And wait, what was all that about? My major was actually Spanish, but I thought I have to do this. But in spite of that, I got a job in Tulsa, actually as a bilingual secretary.
Okay.
So I wanted to stay in Tulsa. But soon what happened was I could not function in the real world. I was not even aware of that, but of course it's crystal clear now. Outside of the bubble, it was the first time that I was on my own living and working in a non-Christian environment.
Right. Okay.
So I was sheltered and naive. Well, that's how people get easily manipulated. So I got into a bad relationship, and that's really when I started falling into what could be called depression.
Okay.
And I was racked with guilt because I was in this relationship, and this relationship was not good. So I was guilty all the time.
Mm.
So what was the solution? Well, run back to a safe place.
I see.
Go back to the Christian bubble. So I don't remember, like, literally planning that, but again, I was convinced that maybe that was proof, like, oh, see, you didn't go serve God, so something bad happened.
Right.
So I need to go back and do that. So I ended up moving to Pasadena, California, eventually working for World Vision.
Okay.
Some people who are my age may know that. I guess they still exist.
I believe they still do, yeah.
Okay. And it was a good organization. Back then, the president was a man named Stan Mooneyham. And it was fine. I met a lot of good people there. And it was a couple years. But I still didn't have relationship skills.
Okay.
Or really life skills. And really no critical thinking skills. So I got into another dysfunctional relationship. It wasn't horrible, but, you know, I'm not progressing as a normal human being.
Okay. Yeah.
What I see now, well, since I've grown and been in therapy, and I said, those of us who grew up in this oppressive system of beliefs were literally developmentally delayed.
Mm.
Wow. I don't have these skills. Well, maybe some people, you know, are taught by their parents, but I didn't have those skills.
I think Bible college has some upsides, but one of the definite downsides is it is infantilizing. It treats you right when you are becoming an adult as a child. And like you say, then you're delayed. All of this kind of steps that a normal 20-year-old would take don't get taken. Then you find yourself, you know, 25, 30, and you still haven't made some of those moves that would be very normal for a 20-something to do.
Exactly. And if when it's an extreme, you could even use a word grooming, which of course has some really dark qualities to it. But that came to mind a few weeks ago when I was reading other people's posts and whatnot. And it struck me and I thought, it's true. It's exactly what they do. Like in my experience, thankfully, I mean, it wasn't anything to do with, you know, grooming for sex or anything, but still you're groomed to be a good little fundamentalist.
Yeah.
That's all you know. So I just kept right on going. And then I decided, okay, it's time to be a missionary.
Okay.
And I decided to join Wycliffe Bible Translators. So that meant moving to Dallas, Texas. So I did that. Within a year or so, I met my husband, who is now my ex-husband.
Okay.
And we were in training. So when you're in training, you go take some classes and a lot of linguistics classes and whatnot. But long story short, so we got married. And of course, the rule is when you're in Wycliffe, you have to marry somebody in Wycliffe. Practically speaking, of course, because one's not going to go overseas and one stay home.
Right.
We just thought, oh, we must have been meant for each other. We got to get married. And I literally believed that the only reason to get married was to serve God together. And that was literally part of our marriage ceremony. I think that's pretty sad now.
Yeah.
Sad.
Let me ask just a question here, though. I mean, did you feel like you loved this person, or was it very transactional?
That's a hard question. I think it was both, but maybe 50-50.
All right. Gotcha.
I don't know. When you're 25, you know, that's the thing to do. You get married. But definitely just having the missions to be the central part of your marriage is extremely dysfunctional.
Okay.
But we were compatible, I must say. Yes, looking back, I mean, we were compatible. And well, since I went through grief recovery when we got divorced, I have no bad feelings about him.
Okay.
Which is wonderful. He's moved on, but
yeah.
But as I'll talk about, the deconstruction was really the one of the last straws.
Okay.
Yeah, but well, recipe for disaster is within 7 months we were in Manila, Philippines.
Mm.
So number one, well, both of our families were not healthy that we came from, you know, dysfunctional okay. families. So putting two people like that together is not a good idea. And newlyweds to go to a third world country is not a good idea.
Yeah, that does. That sounds like the setup for a comedy show of some kind.
Yeah, it wasn't fun at all. And what's maddening is, well, the organization should not be enabling that.
Right.
But it happens. And some people come out of it fine, but we did not. And there's, of course, tons of missionary stories, and I've heard other people have them, so I don't have a corner on this.
Yeah.
But it was funny the other day when I heard somebody on your podcast talking about Papua New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I had a corner on Papua New Guinea, but I don't.
Yeah. I think I can think of two or three people right off the top of my head. So yeah.
Well, it was jumbled, a jumbled mess, but we had to go to jungle camp there in Papua New Guinea. Our assignment was in the Philippines, but we had to go to jungle camp, which, you know, we joke, well, that's like boot camp in the military. And they have a euphemism for it. Now, I don't know what they call it now, but it's just silliness. Some of the silliness is like, oh, we have to build a mud oven and cook food in it.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's real practical. When are we going to use that?
Yeah.
Especially nowadays, thank goodness there's so many more conveniences and whatnot. But it was so long ago that we didn't have computers or cell phones.
Right.
We were not very good at that. At surviving in the jungle.
The jungle part, yeah. Okay.
So this is where, again, the feelings of depression are coming in.
Mm.
And our joke, although it wasn't funny, was that we were misfits, even among misfits. Because missionaries are a weird bunch. But I don't know, it seemed like because we didn't have kids and most of the people were translators and linguists, and we were supposed to be doing anthropology, and we didn't seem to fit in.
Okay.
But what happened was, I guess we pretty much got a bad evaluation at our jungle camp, and we ended up staying in Papua New Guinea for 5 months, and they said, you guys don't adapt very well, but you know, you're going back to Manila. Okay. Going back to our assignment in Manila.
Okay.
We did not thrive very well.
Right.
So that turned into failure. Well, that is one thing you do not want to do, because the whole feeling is that you have an image to keep up. You have to perform. And if you're not doing that, you're letting down your church.
Right.
Your supporters, not to mention your family and friends. And that was a heavy thing to bear. And I mean, all the missionaries are in the same boat. We all know what we're talking about. But of course, it's just swept under the rug. And heaven forbid that you would talk about your problems or struggles, because if you do, that means you're not trusting God, you're weak, blah, blah, blah.
And the level of isolation that you're going through as a missionary, first of all, you're in a foreign country, language that you're just now learning, foreign culture. And on top of that, if you're unable to talk with colleagues, your peers, about important things, that level of isolation would just be really destructive.
It was for me. My husband, not so much. And because he loved anthropology, and he actually liked living in a hut in a village. I was like, are you kidding me? Well, there we were. And yeah, I kept threatening, I'm taking the first flight out to Melbourne, but couldn't do that. Yeah, there was no other white people, of course, in the village. And when we were there, there's about 3 people who died of malaria.
Wow.
And I'm pretty sure that I had it. I had symptoms of that.
Okay.
But on the other hand, I don't want to fail to say that, I mean, that was a life-changing experience that I probably wouldn't trade.
Yeah.
Thank goodness that we were in our 20s. Everybody does crazy things when you're in your 20s that I would never do now. But I mean, it was incredible. Who else lives in a hut in Papua New Guinea?
Yes.
It was just astonishing. And it really does change your worldview. And here's where more doubts are just really sprouting.
Okay.
Because I was faced with this whole thing again, like, well, how can these people be going to hell? And why? And what am I doing here? It's like, just leave these people alone. Why am I coming over to tell them something? It really doesn't make sense.
It makes even less sense when you hear a lot of the apologetic arguments that will say, if the person doesn't know, if they are not informed, that God may go easy on them. But if they know and they reject it, they're going to hell. So the work that missionaries do is effectively making everyone responsible and in theory, within that framework, going to hell.
Oh, I've mused over that at times. That came up somewhere a few weeks ago I was reading, but I remembered from the cobwebs of my mind, there was a man named Don Richardson who wrote a book called Eternity in Their Hearts. And he took one verse out of the Bible. Of course, that's a favorite thing that people do.
Right.
Oh, we're going to take one verse and explain a whole doctrine.
Right.
So there's this verse that says that, you know, everybody has eternity in their hearts. What does that mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything to me anyway. But that proves that every living person knows in their heart that there's a God. And so you better repent. That makes no sense to me.
But. Yeah.
So that was at least one good thing. Was in anthropology, of course, you're studying culture and you're supposed to be aligning with the people and understanding them. And so thank God, we didn't save anybody.
Right.
Now, that's my joke, but
yeah,
we didn't save anybody. And that's the whole issue that came up was, is we're understanding them. And so you're how can you not realize that there is no reason to change these people's way of life? I think maybe that's why missionaries deconstruct.
Yeah.
Because it should be self-evident.
Yeah. For sure. We've had a string of former missionaries, and I think that environment of trying to convey a particular message to a different culture and recognizing the humanity of the people and the correctness of their culture for that people has a very direct way of getting past the denial mechanisms that we would normally have.
It's baffling. So I don't honestly, well, I do remember times when I talked about feelings of depression then, but again, my husband couldn't really understand it. And heaven forbid that I would talk to somebody else about it. Because then, of course, you feel like a failure and like, wow, something's wrong with me. Nobody else is talking about this. So I must be the only one. Okay, well, that's a hallmark for problems in mental health. It's because when you think you're the only one, that's just really where you're sinking.
Yeah.
I want to say in the back of my mind, it was because I wondered, what were we doing there? But it was just a huge combination of this difficult marriage in a third world country, and we weren't succeeding.
Okay.
So what's funny is that we were overseas 2 years, but it was almost like a lifetime.
Yeah.
So I wanted to say to myself, well, what was the big deal? It was only 2 years. Yeah, but it changed everything. And it was so difficult and confusing. And of course, when you're in this system of beliefs, that is your whole identity.
Right.
That's the crazy part, is that you don't really have an identity outside of it. And that's why you can't leave.
Yes, that definitely makes things very difficult. I wanted to point out very quickly, Jan, just how important it is that you're telling this story, because as you mentioned, that feeling of being the only one is very common for people going through deconstruction as well. So both the experience of being a missionary and the experience of going through deconstruction is helping the listeners to recognize that they are not alone in that as well.
Yes, I certainly hope so. Because honestly, this is a unique being able to tell about the mission work, because honestly, most people are not interested at all
right,
in hearing about mission work. When we came home, it was so weird. It was like those people that sent us didn't even want to hear about it. That was just stunning and devastating.
Yeah.
When we talked to people in churches, like they didn't even want to hear our stories. Huh?
Yeah.
But I've told my mental health story many times because I work for, or not I work, but I am a speaker for a mental health organization. But I do hope it helps. I have a passion for talking about it and how to let people know that there's hope. So that's a part of the story that I'm about to go into.
Okay.
Because after we kind of failed, there we were in Manila, and after a while, it became evident that we weren't really functioning. And it was too bad. Well, I was going to say I felt sorry for the people that had to make those decisions, and then I say, wait a minute, those are the people who were supposed to be taking care of us.
Right.
That didn't. It's like, well, we don't know what to do with them. And we made the decision to come home. So we're carrying that mantle of failure. And what was really weird is that, of course, we made plans to leave and come back, come to California. That just so happened to be the week of the coup. That's when there was a peaceful coup deposing Ferdinand Marcos. That was exciting. That was the most exciting thing. Yeah. That was the most exciting thing that ever happened the time we were in Manila. And it was bizarre. Actually, we left for the airport and we had to turn around and come back because the airport was closed.
Wow.
Yeah, it was exciting. But we came to Huntington Beach, California, because at that time, that was where the Wycliffe headquarters were in Huntington Beach.
Okay.
And so we had a home assignment. Well, a home assignment is very difficult to do. And especially like, okay, you're telling your supporters, we're living in Southern California. And they go, what?
Right.
You're living the high life. You're at the beach surfing. Why are we supporting you for doing this? That just made things worse and worse. I think, you know, my husband was not happy that we were home. But on the other hand, I mean, I could give him credit for, okay, we did come home and he was trying his best to make things work. But that went on for probably 2 years. And there's actually some wonderful people in Wycliffe that were at the headquarters.
Okay.
But as I said, little by little, it's like, okay, your support is dropping. That's just always such a difficult thing, the financial part of it. And eventually we had to resign.
Okay.
And we thought, well, we'll just start doing something else. But all this time we're still, okay, we're involved in church. Mm-hmm. And we became involved in a church in the Vineyard. I don't know who else is familiar with that, but
yeah, for sure. I am.
Good old John Wimber, the whole Vineyard movement. So of course this is a progressive Christians and we like that. Mm-hmm. We went to church, but we could not adapt to the real world. Actually, I probably should say that I had a harder time adapting at first to working in the real world. Because again, I mean, we had just been in a Christian bubble.
Yeah, you went from your parents to Bible college to pretty quickly into the training and then to the mission field. So that's a lot of isolation in that bubble.
Yes, and like I said, I mean, we were still young, but to me, it feels like it was a lifetime, even though I deconstructed many, many years ago.
Yeah.
But I can still feel it.
Yeah.
I think it was more like we were floundering because we didn't know what we were going to do with our lives. And as I said, okay, it's almost like a curse. The reason we got married was to serve God. Oh, well, what does that look like now?
Yeah.
And we actually went to Mexico and did our little thing. You know, I'm bilingual and we would do these little things in Mexico, but it just wasn't working. And now I think you can call it depression, but now I realize a lot of it was trauma. And I never would have called it that before because it sounded like it was self-indulgent. And of course, the whole thing, when you're a fundamentalist, it's like, well, you can't claim suffering. I mean, actually, they do like to suffer, but you can't complain.
Right. You have to suffer in silence.
Yes. Well, especially with the mental health. But you're supposed to be happy in suffering. There's just these expectations from family, church, to live up to. Because we never really expressed our feelings and were always hiding. And I never talked to people. I mean, our family was, you know, across the United States. And since we didn't have a healthy relationship with them anyway. And I didn't talk to them about it. And I had one job that I hated. It was isolating. And my husband was off working and he didn't mind that, but it gnawed at him, this whole thing of failing. And especially for him is a big thing, understandably, is he was supposed to be completing his master's degree in anthropology. Well, when you do anthropology, you're supposed to do field work.
Right.
That's what we were supposed to do overseas and he didn't finish. So of course he was frustrated and angry because he didn't finish that, which I understand. And so it was just causing more problems with us. And the bottom line is I became hopeless. And what I'm aware of now is that I did not know I had choices. Now, to me, that sounds now ridiculous, but I literally had never been taught that I had choices. I didn't know that I had a choice in my marriage or what I did or that I could leave the church. That was foreign.
Right.
So I thought I had to just toe the line. Doing that and hiding in silence became intolerable. So I decided, well, there's no way out of this. There's no way out of this. There's no way that I can fix this. And it was just, hopeless. So it culminated one Sunday. My husband and I were driving to church and we were arguing. And we got to the church parking lot and I was crying. And that was kind of unusual. So he said, well, we're not going in. And I said, what? He said, well, we can't go in because you can't go in looking like that, crying. Wow. But I wanted to go in because I wanted to find some comfort or something.
Right.
But he said, no, we're not going in. Wow, that was kind of the last straw.
Okay.
So we drove home and I started making a plan. So we got home and I remember going into silence. And I remember sitting in a chair by the window the entire rest of the day. And he was trying to talk to me and I wouldn't answer. And because I didn't have anything to say. And I thought, okay, I've got to end this. What I did that evening, I went to a drugstore and bought a few packages of sleeping pills. And I didn't want to look suspicious, so I went to a second drugstore and bought more packages of sleeping pills. So the next day, my husband went to work and I called in sick and I got into my car. And what was interesting, it was raining. Well, you know, they say it never rains in Southern California.
Yeah.
That's a lie. Well, it was just to this day, it's kind of surreal, but I tried to start my car, which it always, always started, and it wouldn't start. I thought, okay, it's sprinkling, big deal. The car wouldn't turn over. I thought, oh, come on. You've got to turn over. So finally, it turned over because I was determined for what I was going to do. So I drove up north to the next city and went into a hotel, checked into the room. And after a while, I took all the pills. And I know it sounds odd, but I was relieved. There was a huge sense of relief because I thought the pain is going to be over. That was the whole objective. And I wouldn't have to suffer anymore. Pain was going to be over. I literally felt like there's nothing else to do. I have to do this because I can't fix what's wrong. And I can't bear the distress. Oh, I thought that would work. But I don't understand the whole thing, but I woke up.
Wow.
Yeah, I woke up. I don't know how many hours it was, but the next day I woke up and I was disappointed. I was surprised, and I then had no idea what to do. So it was like starting over a whole cycle of trauma.
Okay.
So it didn't end the pain. It made it worse. So here I was, that was my only solution. Now, what was I going to do? And it involved then more hiding, more silence, which just feeds into the whole idea of the shame. And that's just what's so prevalent with people in the suffering from mental illness. Mm-hmm. It's you're stigmatized. But of course, I just didn't have the skills to obviously function.
Okay.
But I felt like I couldn't tell the truth. So I went home and lied to my husband. And it was kind of like confirmed the reaction that he had, which I'm not making him out to be the bad guy, but you know, instead of being concerned, like, oh my gosh, where have you been and what happened? He said, well, I couldn't sleep last night.
Wow. I'm sorry.
Yeah, because he didn't know where I was. So that told me right there, I guess there's no point in telling him. And who knows what would have happened, but I couldn't risk facing the consequences of what would have happened.
Okay.
But I see that that was extremely, I don't even know the word for it. This may be a poor choice. But we had to go on. Mm-hmm. And we were still married for several years after that.
Okay.
But my doubts continued to grow. And part of it probably was, of course, I was developing really angry feelings toward God. And at one point, it was like, why didn't you help me? Which now, of course, I see how silly that is. But, you know, here I had this traumatic experience. And then it's like, well, why didn't you intervene?
Right.
Because there was silence.
Yeah.
I didn't hear anything. I don't know what I expected, but you know, I mean, that's what you're raised to believe, like, whoa, God's going to speak to you.
Yeah.
And I said, you didn't say anything.
That silence is painful.
It is. It was. And of course, again, I was alone. So I didn't tell anybody what I had done for several years. And nobody should have to go through that. But at one point, it was probably a little bit after that, but I remember at one point, I don't know at what point you would call in the deconstruction, but I said, I just remember thinking, well, God, you hate me and I hate you too.
Okay.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
So it was like, fine, tit for tat. You hate me. I hate you. I could care less. And yeah, I was never going back to church.
Okay. I think I've heard some people use the analogy of divorcing God, you know, and that seems apropos.
Oh yeah. We had irreconcilable differences.
That's right. Yes. You wanted to consciously uncouple. Yeah.
We are not getting along here. We're not on the same page at all. But that just reminds me of this one church that we were in at that point. We had actually moved and weren't going to the Vineyard anymore, but we went to this church. And I talked to this woman over lunch. And I think it was probably the first time that I had said anything about we were having marriage problems. And she said, well, is he physically abusing you? And I said, no. And she said, well, then you do not have any reason at all to consider divorce. Now, that's always a good one.
Again, someone telling you you don't have a choice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's no compassion. It's just, oh, no, let's look at the rules here. Rule one, rule two, rule three. Okay, sorry. You don't qualify.
No empathy.
No, it's like, suck it up, girl. You better just make a way to make this work. Needless to say, I never went back there.
Yeah.
When we were still going to this Vineyard church, I had something happen that was a huge milestone. And what that was I found one other person who was going through the same thing, deconstruction. I wouldn't even call it that. It was the doubts.
Sure.
It was a game changer. So it happened one day because in my mind, so of course, totally alone, I had not said a peep to anybody on earth about these nagging doubts until that day. It was one Sunday after church, and we had made friends with another couple. And after church, I ended up chatting with him. And another really funny aside about he and I is that we have the exact same birthday. So we found out we were born on the same day in the same year, like 12 hours apart.
Okay.
And he was born in Washington, D.C., and I was born in Iowa. So I call him my twin.
Yeah.
So this is really odd. So when he and I went through, at that time, I called it a faith crisis. That's what it was.
Uh-huh. Sure.
We went through the faith crisis at exactly the same time.
Okay.
So go figure. So we're after church, and we start talking, and I don't know how it came up, but it was like, you know, I don't know if I believe this. Really? So we're whispering.
Yeah.
I'm having doubts about this. Well, me too. And I remember saying something about Christianity is just too narrow for me. I just can't do this. And he goes, yeah, I know. So it was astonishing. Like, this person that I can talk to.
A moment of honesty. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. And what happened was that I got divorced first. Before he did.
Okay.
But I mean, that was just simply the end of everything. I got to the point where I said, we're never going to reconcile these differences. So we need to do something. We need to get divorced. And he was passive about it. But anyway, in the end, you know, we got divorced.
Okay.
And my friend did later. At that point, after I was divorced, his wife did not want me to talk to him.
Yeah. Okay.
Probably for several reasons, but she was freaking out that he was deconstructing.
Yeah.
And so she didn't want me to talk to him. And so that was a blow. Here I'd finally found one human being that I could talk to, and I couldn't anymore. However, the footnote on that is years later, he got divorced and we reconnected, and now he's my landlord.
Interesting. Okay. Oh. All right.
Bizarre turn of events.
Yes.
That we've been friends for 30 years or something.
Okay. Yeah, that's awesome.
But so here I was. I think this is so difficult for people outside of religious belief systems can't understand. Your whole life just went down the drain.
Right. Right.
I got divorced and I left the church, and it was like jumping off a cliff with no parachute.
Right.
And I had at that time nobody, well, I had a couple friends, but of course most of the church people fell away. It was like, oh my God, you're not one of us anymore.
Yeah.
And I didn't really want to be one of them. And I did not talk to anybody about it. So that was crushing. And it very confusing. So the last thing my husband said to me, I remember sitting in the living room, and the last thing he said that I remember was, "You're lost and you're floating out to sea." It's funny now, but at that time, I can honestly say it was kind of terrifying.
Oh, I imagine, yeah.
Because I didn't know what I was doing. It was just that I could not go back. I couldn't go back, but I had nowhere to go. And so it was a bit terrifying.
Absolutely. I think you've just described deconstruction for many, many people. It's that they come to the conclusion that they can't go back long before you have any idea where you're going, right? Like where you go next,
yes.
Right? It's just, this is untenable. I cannot sustain this. Something has to change. And many, many people are in that spot and don't even know where to look to start to get some answers.
Exactly. Fortunately, I did find something, but it was because it's, again, your whole identity has been wrapped up in that, which means that your family and friends and career have been all wrapped up into one little bundle.
Mm-hmm.
And that is no longer existing.
Right.
So fortunately, at that time, I started a new teaching career. So I think when my husband and I were splitting up and I said, well, I've got to support myself, obviously. I mean, I'd always worked, but I thought, well, I wanted to teach and why not? I've got to support myself. And so I had just got my teaching credential and I threw myself into my work. It's all first year teachers know this. It's just crazy. You work 7 days a week.
Yeah.
And that was probably good for me at that time, except that I kind of then didn't have time to even pretend to build new relationships.
Mm.
But I worked so much that it was okay. And actually, I mean, there's two sides to it. On one hand, it was traumatizing. But on the other hand, I had this new freedom.
Yeah.
I had freedom from an unhappy marriage, and I had freedom from God, because I said, I hate you. Fine.
Yeah.
So I did have some feelings of freedom.
Yeah.
Then a huge milestone was I ended up going to a month-long self-help program in Massachusetts. And it was pretty amazing. It was life-changing. And I met a lot of people that, I hate to use the label, but kind of new age.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, I didn't even know what they were talking about. Some of their language, their phrases.
Yeah.
I'd never heard. I just remember this one woman saying, I just have to be really grounded. And I thought, well, what the heck does that mean?
Yeah.
But I loved it. I loved everything about being grounded and getting into yoga and new ways of thinking. I started reading all the books. I mean, the whole thing, Deepak Chopra, Wayne Dyer, Louise Hay, tons of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
When I came back, it started a new chapter. And also extremely significant was getting into a Unity church. Don't call it a church anymore, and people always confuse Unity with Unitarian.
Okay.
But what happened was like 2 days after I got back from this whole month-long experience, I looked at a flyer in the mail. And it's so funny because I think, who looks at junk mail? Nobody looks at junk mail. I don't look at that stuff. But it was this little flyer from the Unity Center. And it said, spiritual, but not religious. And I thought, And I'm surprised that I even looked at it, because You know, I had made this vow that I'm never, ever going to a church again. Ever. But that intrigued me. And I called the phone number. I called the phone number and somebody answered. And I said, got this flyer in the mail and it sounded interesting. And I said, you aren't evangelical, are you? They said, no. And I said, good. And they said, well, why don't you, you know, come on Sunday and try. I went the next Sunday and I went on and off for 20 years.
Okay.
It was extremely helpful for my deconstruction. There were so many times when I did, because it's so complicated. I mean, so much the doctrine we taught is so huge and so crazy that it takes a long time to deconstruct it. But I remember specific times when I would think of something. I don't know why something was so funny to me that I remember the street that I was driving on.
Okay.
One day, I started thinking about the age of accountability. And I thought, come on. So that, I don't know if, I think it's a fundamentalist thing. So, which means that when you're born as a baby, well, when you're a baby, you're innocent and you don't know any better. But when you hit that age of accountability, you better watch out. You know that you're a sinner and you know that you better repent. I thought about that and I just burst out laughing.
Yeah.
I thought, who invented this nonsense?
Yeah.
I go, so what age is that? 7 or 6 and a half or 7 3/4 or come on.
Yeah.
It just, and to this day, I have to admit that there are still things that come up that I have to go through that mental process, realizing what nonsense it is.
Right.
Astonishing.
It is a lot to unpack, for sure. This is a lifelong process, I imagine. How about today, these days? What are you finding meaning in? What are you finding helpful?
Yes, good question. Well, one of my quests is just to have adventure and have fun.
Yeah, sounds good.
And I do that. I'm an adventurer. I love things like skydiving. I'm still active, hiking, roller skating, paintball. The other day I did axe throwing.
Wow. Yeah, that's cool.
I really like that. But I have to give a shout out to therapy. So because, as I said, I love to talk about mental health. And I speak with an organization called NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Okay.
And so I've spoke to groups dozens of times, hundreds of times. And one of the mistakes that I made in my journey was that I did not go to therapy. And so it's a huge regret, but as we've learned, it's like you have to forgive yourself and move on. But I have been in therapy for 2 years. I'm just transitioning out.
Okay.
We did EMDR, which is extremely effective. A lot of people love it. And because, you know, I thought that I was done with anger, and I realized that I wasn't done with anger.
Got it.
Even though I had gone through anger workshop where I got to, it was great. I screamed and yelled about all the things my parents did or didn't do, mm-hmm. and relationships, and yelled at God. But what happened is that in the past, 5 or 6 years, everybody knows how crazy the politics has been.
Yeah.
And I won't name names or anything, but it's been really devastating because politics as well as religion has ruined some of my family relationships.
Yeah. I think for many of us, that's the case, but yeah.
Oh, extremely common. So I know I'm not alone. That's where I'm finding a lot of comfort, but it was just devastating. And one thing was I had become very close to a couple in the Unity Church. They were like my surrogate family. Mm-hmm. And they went into the whole QAnon community.
Oh boy.
I was absolutely shocked and devastated. So I had to work through that.
I bet. Yeah.
But on the other hand, these Facebook groups have been a lifesaver for me. And I want to make sure that I give a shout out.
Yeah.
It was a few months ago. I just stumbled into it. We all know how the internet works like that.
Yeah.
But it's just been fabulous. I started joining these groups of people who had deconstructed. Mm-hmm. I can't even keep track of how many. I'm in a few. Not just a few.
Yeah.
And it was just game changing for me. My therapist was so happy because she understands like the religious trauma. And I didn't even know there was a name for it until months ago.
Right.
Religious trauma.
Yep.
But unless you've been through it, you know, you really can't honestly understand it. But now that I found these groups, it's like, oh, yes.
Yes. My people.
And my analogy is I have to control myself, you know, on my phone because I can spend a lot of time on these posts. It's like going to an all-you-can-eat smorgasbord. I mean, I was just consuming this information because I was comforted by these people. And even though I was full, I still kept going back for more.
Yeah. I call that the information gathering stage. You go through this point where you've been looking for water and you find this well of information and you just have to take in as much as you possibly can. And like, again, very
exactly.
Common experience. Yeah.
Well, it was the community.
Yeah.
It was just that not being alone because, you know, I have friends, but there's not one single one of them here who has gone through what I've gone through. Mm-hmm. So, this is how stunning it was for me. It was actually through one of your episodes. So okay. When you interviewed the couple and Paul and Deb.
Yeah.
And I don't know them personally, only yeah. on Facebook. But I was so struck by that. When I heard him tell his missionary story, I was just blown away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I mean, this is silly, but I didn't know that other people had deconstructed. And I was so thrilled that a missionary had done it.
Yes.
I was so excited.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I tracked them down. I was like on a hunt. And I found them online. And he directed me to the Faith Shift group. And I was astonished. And he said, oh, there's Wycliffe people there. I said, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. I got into the group and I just posted something like, wow, thanks for letting me in the group. And, you know, I was with Wycliffe and whatnot. And immediately there was all these welcomes.
Yeah.
It was overwhelming. All the people were, you know, doing the likes and the hearts and saying, welcome, welcome. I was overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And at first I started crying. And I mean, that's kind of unusual for me. And at first it was just, oh, that's so nice.
Yeah.
And they kept coming. And all of a sudden I started sobbing. I was like, what is going on here?
Right.
And when people being so kind and welcoming And I had to go get the Kleenex box. And it took three or four. I mean, I was sobbing for 5 minutes. And then I went, whoa, something's going on here.
Yeah.
It was like this primal or tribal thing or in the body somatic thing that was happening. And it's like I could release something because I had been, you know, alone in this specific kind of deconstruction for so long.
Right.
And so to know other people had done that was overwhelmingly fabulous.
I cannot say enough good things about the Deconversion Anonymous Facebook group that Arlene is running. And I am amazed at the empathy that just gets poured out. And what's beautiful about it is that there are distinctions between our experiences. So I had no connection to Wycliffe, but there are four or five, 10 people that have been. And so they can respond and know exactly what you've been going through.
Mm. They did. So here's the, you know, another huge thing. Yeah. Within minutes, this friend of mine from 40 years ago types in the post.
Wow.
And we connected and she was like, Jan, that, you know, that's you.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, are you kidding me? And I mean, it was stunning. Number one, because it had been 40 years. And number two, it's like, you're one of us.
mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And we're still almost feeling like we're tiptoeing around. But it was like, oh, you too?
Yes.
We started exchanging furiously this amount of messages privately. And I'm telling you, that happened on a Thursday, I'm pretty sure. And as I said, we were communicating privately. That Sunday, we met.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I was just blown away.
Yeah.
And because come to find out, we live less than 2 hours apart.
Okay.
And we met halfway. And we talked for over 9 hours.
Wow. That's amazing. That's such a fantastic story. I love that.
We could not stop talking. And,
yeah.
And we still, like the tip of the iceberg, but it was like, I can't believe we used to be young.
Yeah.
And now look at us. We're old, but, and look what we've been through.
Yeah.
We survived. It's surreal, but I couldn't be more thrilled.
Yeah, that's amazing. Jan, unfortunately, our time is wrapping up here, but I want to give you an opportunity to give some advice or some direction for someone who finds themselves in a similar place where they feel like they don't have choices and they're starting to make poor decisions. What should they be doing?
So it sounds like what you're talking about as far as mental health.
Yeah.
The silence is literally deadly. And my mantra is, there's no reason for shame. So if somebody thinks that they have a reason to be silent and to feel shame, I will tell you, you do not have to. And if, you know, they always say, you know, reach out to someone, that's hard. And I'm sure that there's a place for 1-800 numbers. I've never called one because it feels really impersonal.
Okay.
But I just encouraged people to find a compassionate person and don't be afraid to be vulnerable. I know that's extremely difficult, but I've been in that situation on both sides and, yes, to know that it is not hopeless, that you have choices, and there are people waiting to point you in the right direction, to get you resources, and to tell you what choices you have, and to show you coping skills. Because that's the thing that helps me. I still have symptoms. I struggle with challenges, and I've developed an arsenal of coping skills.
I like that, an arsenal of coping skills.
Mm-hmm.
Jen, if somebody wanted to reach out to you, how might they do that?
Only one simple way right now is, I would say, the email. Of course, well, I'm on Facebook, but I will put out my email. It's a little different. It's quantum, because I'm a fan of quantum physics.
Cool.
The word quantum, and then there's an underscore, and seven, the number seven, at sbcglobal.net.
Great. We will have that in the show notes for people to be able to reach out to you. And if you want to, we can also put a link to your Facebook page if you'd like.
Sure.
Jen, I just want to thank you so much for sharing your story with such honesty and vulnerability. I think for sure this is going to have a huge impact on the listeners.
I can only hope so. And I thank you so much.
Final thoughts on the episode. I really appreciate Jan's honesty, her ability to tell her story of mental health struggles with vulnerability, and helping us to understand the visceral feeling of being alone, the shame, the issues surrounding mental health. I also deeply appreciate her message that you are not alone, that there is always hope, you always have a choice, and I hope that that is the main message that you got from Jan's story. Jan is also a quote machine. I have written down a number of quotes. Go back and listen again. She has a really eloquent way of describing the deconstruction process. I'll mention just one here. And heaven forbid that I would talk to somebody else about it, because then, of course, you feel like a failure. Wow, something is wrong with me. Nobody else is talking about this, so I must be the only one. Similar to the mental health issues, deconstruction and deconversion is also incredibly isolating and can feel like you are the only one. Another part of Jan's story that I think is amazing is her recent discovery of a whole community of people who have deconstructed and deconverted. It was particularly important to Jan that people like Deb and Paul, who were former missionaries and specifically had worked with Wycliffe Bible translators, was really important for her to know that her story is not unique, that there are more people out there just like her. And I find that deeply, deeply important for those of you who are in the midst of those questions. Maybe you don't even know what the word deconstruction means, but the point is that others have had doubts, others have come out the other side of those doubts and survived and thrived even. The theme of choice came up over and over in Jan's story. She began by talking about how, as a child, you have no choice, that many of you were raised in fundamentalist evangelical environments, and that was not your choice. It was also brought up in the theme of mental health, when it feels like there are no choices, and there always are. Jan felt like she had never been taught that she had choices, that she could choose to leave her poor marriage. She could choose to leave the church. She had choices. And now, on this side of deconstruction, she has even more choices. She has options. And she is deciding what is important to her and the direction of her life. A few shout-outs here. We will have links for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I'll have links for the Secular Therapy Project, which is a great resource if you're looking for a therapist, as well as Recovering from Religion if you need someone to talk to about deconstruction immediately. They are available 24 hours a day. I'll have all of those links in the show notes. If you find yourself in a moment of thinking that there are no choices, please reach out. You do have choices. There is hope, and you are not alone. I want to thank Jan for being on the podcast, for telling her story, for being incredibly vulnerable and honest about mental illness, about deconstruction, about her life. Thank you so much, Jan, for telling your story. The Secular Grace thought of the week is, how could it not be? You are not alone. As I mentioned in the intro, I recently did Instagram Live with Robert Peoples of Affinis Humanity and told my story. And in that retelling, I remembered the feeling of the moment that I admitted to myself that I no longer believed and how utterly alone I felt. I had no idea that the deconversion community existed. I knew that there were atheists out there, but that is different, as Jan rightly pointed out. Even some of her current friends who love her and care for her don't understand the experience of having been a person of faith forever, for being a missionary even in her case, and subsequently not able to believe any longer. So the message of the podcast is, if you're hearing this, you are not alone. There are many, many people who have gone through this before you. And I loved Jan's description of the Facebook community and how welcoming and warm and empathetic the people are, that it ultimately brought her to tears as people welcomed her and were glad that she was a part of the community. So as always, here's an invitation to become a part of the Deconversion Anonymous community on Facebook. It is a private group. We respect anonymity. You're safe there. You can join that at facebook.com/groups/deconversion. And Arlene, our community manager, is amazing at facilitating conversation. There are a number of book clubs. There are a number of ongoing live discussions that you can participate in. But ultimately, it's just a place where you don't have to edit yourself. You can be authentically yourself and talk about your questions, and people are not going to judge you. They're going to support you. Next week, we have Jack Robertson, a member of our community, and he is telling the story of his daughter's accident, where she experienced some very deep burns and is still in recovery from that. But he also goes into the experience of well-meaning but hurtful statements that came from Christians around him. And we're just going to explore that idea, how you support people who are suffering. I'm also in discussions with a couple of different authors, and hopefully we're going to have some very interesting episodes coming up. Until then, my name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. Time for the footnotes. The beat is called Waves from Makai Beats. Links will be in the show notes. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can promote it on your social media. You can subscribe to it in your favorite podcast application, and you can rate and review it on podchaser.com. You can also support the podcast by clicking on the affiliate links for books on gracefulatheist.com. If you have podcast production experience and you would like to participate with the podcast, please get in touch with me. Have you gone through a faith transition and do you need to tell your story? Reach out. If you are a creator or work in the deconstruction, deconversion, or secular humanism spaces and would like to be on the podcast, just ask. If you'd like to financially support the podcast, there's links in the show notes. To find me, you can Google Graceful Atheist. You can Google Deconversion. You can Google Secular Grace. You can send me an email, gracefulatheist@gmail.com. Or you can check out the website, gracefulatheist.com. My name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. This has been the Graceful Atheist Podcast.